You're listening to Earful of Queer on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. This morning we're talking to Craig Fortier from No One Is Illegal about the support campaign for Alvaro Orozco. Alvaro Orozco was released from the Immigration Holding Center yesterday, June 2nd. In this interview we discuss the success of the campaign and politicizing queers in this migrant justice movement and the ongoing struggle to stop the deportations and removal of our beloved folks from our communities. I was wondering if you could start out by maybe giving folks a bit of a background on Alvaro's release and his detainment.
Sure. So I guess maybe the best place to start is on May 13th, Alvaro was coming home from a art exhibit that he was putting on with the Mayworks Festival, and as he was on his way actually to meet somebody for dinner, he was randomly picked up and ID'd by a Toronto police officer who targeted him and asked him to see identification. He obviously couldn't produce papers to be in the country, and so he showed him what he had, and the police officer brought him into the station and looked him up and found that he had a warrant out for a deportation warrant. And so they called the Immigration Ministry. As probably folks probably know, Toronto Police actually is under no obligation and under no jurisdiction to enforce immigration stuff. So, and you know, they also are under no obligation to be randomly profiling people. So it was really concerning to us, but Alvaro was picked up and brought into immigration detention and set for deportation at that time. So that was on May 13th. From that time onward, there was almost daily actions in the community, various things, press conferences, postering, meetings, flash mobs, all kinds of stuff to attempt to either build profile on his case or to show sort of the establishment he's had in the community, because the one thing that he still had left in the system was a humanitarian and compassion application. The unfortunate thing is that humanitarian and compassion actually can't stop a deportation. So really it was the mobilization of his friends and community members here in Toronto that really was effective in eventually having his agency heard in really quick fashion, and we got word just a couple days ago that it was accepted and he was released yesterday, and he's with friends and community again today, and we're going to have a huge celebration picnic for him on Sunday.
Yay!
Yeah, it's really great.
Yeah, totally. I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about his humanitarian and compassionate application, and I guess like what that means for Alvaro now.
Yeah, sure. So, well, humanitarian and compassionate is an interesting avenue, because once your refugee file has been denied and you've lost your pre-removal risk assessment, which is an assessment essentially to see if you're in imminent danger of death or violence when you're returned, which most people lose. The agency is another application you can file based on your establishment in the community. So essentially, there's nothing really humanitarian and compassionate about it. It's more about whether or not, you know, you've worked during your time in Canada, whether you've contributed to various volunteerism and community work, so on and so forth. And, you know, obviously most people fail that application as well, particularly because it's very difficult for people who are living without status or with precarious immigration status, and if, especially if they have families, to do a whole bunch of community work on top of working jobs that usually pay under minimum wage. But Alvaro did have a strong application. You know, he had been very active within the arts community, the queer community, and all kinds of different volunteer opportunities and volunteer work, including a couple awards, and most recent being the Youth Line GLBT Award for Artist of the Year for 2011. So, you know, all these awards and community support made his application really strong. But like as I said before, humanitarian compassion actually doesn't stop at deportation. So we were really afraid, you know, this was a very low probability chance for him to win. I think the rates are anywhere, people have said anywhere between 3 to 5%.
That's so really low.
It is very low. And so his victory was incredible because partly based on the amount of mobilization, I think, that collective action that people took. And that was a really important component. And, you know, our message all along was if they want to show that Alvaro has establishment in the community, well, we're going to physically bring the community to the establishments that need this. And so we had a number of actions at the Immigration Refugee Board, and we also had a whole bunch of actions at Church in Wellesley, which is in the heart of the queer community in Toronto. So, you know, it was really, really inspiring to see so many people come out and, you know, be a part of that movement. And I think, Alvaro, and we believe that that was a real big part in having his agency heard really rapidly, and that was good.
And so this has been an incredibly successful campaign. Alvaro's released, and you're all going to celebrate on Sunday. But I'm wondering about the ways that you want to see this momentum and community support continue to grow and where you all want to go from here.
Well, I think that's the most important question, and I think what we've tried to say all along and what we keep on saying is that we want to show that if we organize collectively, it works and we can win. But winning one case, you know, it's a victory and it's incredible to make sure that Alvaro stays in that community. But winning one case is not changing the conditions that put him in that place in the first, put him in that space in the first place. And so, you know, our next steps are going to be the important ones. And so we believe that, you know, we need to have ongoing work, particularly in the queer community, because we feel that it may be, under the Jason Kenney immigration regime, a community that's under target for deportation. You know, this government has shown its ability to directly pick various communities and focus on significant deportations within them. And so we want to ensure that there's strong, coordinated, mobilized resistance, collective action, not only to fight deportations, but to actually start to challenge the immigration laws that put people in this vulnerable position in the first place.
Yeah, totally. That's really important. I want to talk a bit about how folks can get involved with No One Is Illegal.
Yeah, so I think, you know, while No One's Illegal is only a part of this really important movement, what we see, though, is that more and more people identify with and believe in the idea that no one is illegal. So, and that really is the number one goal of our group, is that we need to start to change the way we all think about immigration and stop the criminalization and vilifying of people who are just seeking to escape the types of displacement that Canada creates and our companies create. We see right now, actually today, happening this afternoon, there's going to be a huge rally against Barrick Gold and for their actions in Tanzania recently, where people are dying because of their mining operations and Barrick being a big Toronto-based Canadian mining company. So, you know, it's really important that people organize collectively wherever they're at. And No One Is Illegal here in Toronto and Vancouver, Montreal, Ottawa, Halifax, other places where the groups exist are important spaces to do that. And whether you're in a city where there is a No One Is Illegal, you know, there are open groups and you're free to come in and work with us. Or if there isn't, you know, those are spaces, you know, where people can collectivize there as well. So we've seen in Guelph really important collective work done with Fuerza Puerza, which is a group that supports migrant workers there, right? And that was, again, you know, people coming together and saying that collective action works. And we're seeing that more and more. And so, you know, we would definitely welcome people. So if you want to get involved in Toronto, what no one is illegal, you can go onto our website. Our meetings are every Wednesday, and they are open to anybody who's interested and willing to work around these issues. You can just send us an email, and we'll give you the details on how you can get involved. But, you know, there's various ways, and folks who even just took the time to make those phone calls, you know, that's an important first step for us to be able to build a wider network of people talking about these issues and addressing the members of government who have power over these things.
Something you said earlier that I kind of wanted to go back to was kind of the idea of, like, politicizing more queer folks around, like, migrant justice issues, and that was really exciting to see a lot of queers taking to the streets to support Alvaro.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it seems like in this whole struggle for funding of Pride, you know, and that's an important struggle, but in that whole struggle, you know, begging the city for money to have a party, essentially, we forgot that the roots of Pride, you know, this is the 30th anniversary of the resistance to the bathhouse rates. This year marks 30 years that people stood up in the queer community, you know, people who actually, some of those people who were actually at Alvaro's rallies, you know, like the original people who were standing up, still stay true to that politicization that occurred back in 1981. And so, you know, we can't forget our history, and it's so easy for that history to be erased, and for people to feel like progress has been made and that's good enough. What we're seeing more and more is that, you know, being openly queer is only, you know, and not necessarily even queer, but gay and male tends to be the only, and rich tends to be the only true liberation that we're seeing within the community. And there remains lots of struggle to happen. And I think the folks who were part of the bathhouse raids rebellion still believe that the struggle continues and that we need to continue to mobilize and politicize. And it was, you're right, it was incredible to see the look in people's eyes and the questions that were people were asking, like, that, you know, on the day that we found out Alvaro's release, we were having a press conference. We didn't know he was going to be released at that point. And we didn't know that he would be coming home and he'd have permanent residence and he'd be eligible to apply for citizenship, you know. But what I saw in people's eyes was this sense that, you know what, it's time for us to actually fight this racist system. And that is something I think that we need to see more and more of within the queer community. And it was so uplifting to see so many people who came on board, you know, young and old, people from all different types of the queer community, which is something we haven't seen in the past. Generally speaking, you know, this movement has been led primarily by young queer women of color, and they've been left alone, left hanging on various movements and various struggles. And to see, you know, just older groups and younger groups and white and people of color and all kinds of other people organizing in that space with a goal of not just stopping Alvaro's deportation, but really fighting this attack on our community. I think that's an incredible thing, and I think we need to foster that, and hopefully we can build here in Toronto. But all that momentum that took place all across Canada, in, you know, we saw it in Montreal, people in Vancouver, just throughout Southern Ontario, and I think that's the type of momentum that, you know, we need to remember that history, and we need to make sure we tell the story that way, right? Because I even read a Toronto Star article that really spoke very marginally about the effect of collective power and collective resistance in fighting Alvaro's deportation. And we can't let that story be changed like the story of Pride was changed 30 years ago.
Yeah, totally.
There's actually a really good professor named Deva Stasialis. I'm not sure if she's at York now still, but back in like 1989, she wrote an article called something called like Minority Resistance in Toronto, but it had to do with the Black and Caribbean community and the queer community mobilizing right around the same time in the late 70s, early 80s, and the types of shifts they did. And reading that article, you know, just hearing about how, like, during, after the bathhouse raids, that, like, people overturned police cars and lit them on fire. And then with the G20 last year, people in awe and shock that there were police cars on fire as though it never happened in their history. Those are things that were lost, you know. Those are things that we need to see as part of an ongoing story of the types of resistance that were required in order for people to safely march down the street on Pride. And, you know, it's funny how easily the story gets shifted, right, and how easily it gets taken out of the hands of regular community members and put into the hands of particular leaders.